Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, the latest geek culture news, and whatever movies, TV, and other pop culture is on our radar for the week. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. All right, for those of you who don't know, it is Batman weekend this weekend.
All things Batman.
Yes.
All the time.
Well, more specifically, it's Batman Day on Saturday, September 17th, which is this Saturday. So you can come out, get a free Batman number one while supplies last. It may go all day. Who knows?
Yeah.
And 15% off on all things Batman. And also, Batman and Catwoman themselves will be here from noon to 3.
That is a lot of stuff.
A lot of stuff. Oh, and Devin Kraft will be here doing Batman sketches, and also we'll have prints. Hopefully he's got some Overwatch prints to sell.
Yay! What period will he be in, or do we know?
Probably about that noon to 3 area as well.
Okay.
Yep. So yeah, midday on Saturday will be a lot of stuff. Later that night, starting about 6, we're doing about 7, we're doing Smash Up for our Gaming with Rogues. You can come in and play Smash Up with us. Then on September 25th, that's a Sunday, we're doing our Magic the Gathering Kaladesh pre-release. And then just a reminder, October, we've got our Reading with Rogues, and for the rest of this month, Batman Long Halloween is 15% off, 25% off if you got a Rogue card, and next month's going to be Harrow County Volume 1. So, we wanted to talk about a few things, a couple anniversaries. First, let's hit the news, and then we'll talk about the anniversary stuff.
Yep.
So, first of all, just a bit of interesting news. The game Journey, which Dave has lauded before.
Yeah, video game Journey. It's a PlayStation exclusive.
Is on PlayStation Plus as the free game this month. So if you have PlayStation Plus, like you would if you're playing any kind of online games on PS3 or PS4, go download Journey for free.
Yep. I did it last night, and I will play it at some point when I don't want to play Overwatch.
That's where I'm at, too. But my son played it, and the music is beautiful, and it's really nice looking.
Oh, he tried out?
Yeah, he tried out.
Yeah, I will say, Journey is not a game to play when you're in the Overwatch mood. It's a kind of chill-out kind of game. It is definitely not an action game.
I could do some chill-out, so...
Yep.
They're doing an Alien Nation remake.
They're actually doing... We talked about this like a year or two ago.
But Jeff Nichols is directing it, and that's the guy who did my Midnight Special, which I didn't see. Did you see that, Dave?
No.
But Nick did, right?
Midnight Special.
Midnight Special?
I don't even know what that is.
The kid with the psychic powers or something?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I'm linked on that one. But yeah, no, I saw that one. I enjoyed it.
Okay. It was getting good buzz for a while.
Yeah. I think that wasn't his first movie. He did another one, too.
I don't know. It was his big...
But that was his bigger one. Yeah, no, I enjoyed it quite a bit. I could see him pulling off an Alien Nation because it's got that sort of subdued kind of... Or he's got sort of kind of like the... Just sort of indie kind of feel to it. So if you brought that to Midnight Nation...
And, you know, the original one was very much a buddy cop movie.
Yep.
With the backdrop of, you know, the alien newcomers, you know, it's kind of a metaphor for immigrant relations.
Gee, you think that's a topic that's notable these days?
Somehow, even more than it was conceived.
I wonder, and I would like to see them tweak. That's the best reason to do a remake of a movie that's perfectly fine. This movie doesn't need a remake.
Yeah.
But the best reason to do a remake is because its themes can use an updating.
Yeah.
And I definitely think there's something to be said about... you know, people who want to get, for example, someone wanted the aliens to build a force field around the Earth and they would pay for it.
Right. We need a demagogue.
Yes.
Is it going to be an exploration of what it would be like under an orange-faced presidency?
I don't know. I don't know who you could be talking about.
Hey, what was the song in the original Alien Nation that ends at? Is it like, put a little love in your heart?
It might
at
be.
At the wedding?
Yeah.
It's pretty cheesy.
Here's my question. Who do you cast for those leads? Because you had Mandy Patinkin and James Caan. That's a really good pair.
For a movie that's kind of, like, not great, like a little mediocre at times,
yeah.
They pushed it through to becoming a really watchable movie. You know, it could be done.
I think for one thing, I think we'll probably see... Is a diversity, and it'd be interesting if they gender flip so that one of the cops is a woman.
I suspect they'll probably do something like that. I also think that they made, you know, not even do it necessarily the straight up buddy partnership. Like, what if there was like a squad that was like the newcomer squad where they integrate and train alongside, and you've got a few cops, kind of like, you know, if it's a TV show, right?
No, it's a movie.
Oh, it's a movie. Oh, for some reason I was thinking it was a TV show.
No,
they did consider it as a TV show,
yeah,
right?
But it is a movie.
Okay. But even so, I can almost see something like that where it's slightly more of an ensemble thing.
I'd like that. That'd be cool.
Change it up, break it up a little bit from its, you know, buddy cop stuff. Can it help but follow a certain formula?
Here's my other pitch.
Yeah?
Adam Sandler plus Kevin James equals Alien Nation.
No.
I wish you guys could have seen the disappointment in Dave's face. It was like he both wanted to be sad and slap me.
Yeah, the slapping was actually the winning out.
What about Rob Schneider and Adam Sandler?
Okay. Let's move on to Katie Sackhoff is recurring on Rebels in a role that she originated in Clone Wars.
Correct.
This is a character I don't know, or at least I don't remember.
Well, she showed up in Clone Wars, I think.
I haven't seen all of Clone Wars yet.
Oh, okay. So she does show up later in the run of Clone Wars.
So what is her character in Clone Wars?
I think she's a bounty hunter, if I'm not mistaken, if I'm remembering correctly.
Okay.
Not in this... What was the... One bounty hunter that had worked with the young Boba Fett. Why am I blanking on her name?
It's the with ponytail.
Not Asajj Ventress, but...
Right.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, I don't remember her name either.
I think it's something akin to that, where she's kind of a badass bounty hunter.
Okay, all right.
But, which, you know, Katie Sackhoff can play a badass of anything. So.
Sure.
So it's fun that she's back as that same character.
The connective tissue between Rebels and Clone Wars has really been fun. Well, okay, they said, in the article I read, they said that she had some kind of relationship with Darth Maul. Like, she helped him go after his... the Witches of Dathomir or something? After Dooku?
I was going to say after Dooku, because Dooku basically killed all of the Witches of Dathomir.
Right, okay.
Which is his people.
Okay.
His family.
So, Maul, of course, had a pretty major resurgence in Rebels.
He did.
So maybe that's where she's coming in.
Probably. She'll probably join forces with him. But I remember, like, an episode, really, with her and Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Okay.
Being really awesome. Towards the end. Did you finish Clone
Nope.
Wars?
Nope.
How am I the only person here? And you were the one who got me into Clone Wars.
Yeah, that's funny.
Look, I'd watch Clone Wars, but I have to finish rewatching Terriers the fifth time.
By the way, just for the record, I looked it up. Aura Singh.
Okay. Aura Singh, yes. There we go. Yeah. Okay. This one I like because of the name of the actress. So they're doing that film, I Kill Giants.
Correct.
Zoe Saldana is going to play like the sort of mentor character. And they have cast the lead character.
Based on the comic, I Kill Giants.
Yes, based on the comic, I Kill Giants. Based on my autobiography, I Kill Giants. in which I murder the New York Giants.
Oh.
Yeah. And I bury them under Giants Stadium.
Whoa. Keep going.
Anyway. The actress is Imogen Poots.
Yes.
Which is my favorite actress name ever. I don't know where I've seen him.
She was in the remake of Fright Night, and she was in that movie that Dave hated, The Green Room.
So she's been in movies I have not seen.
Probably. She's probably been in something you've seen, and I just don't remember.
Was she in The Nice Guys?
No, I don't think she was.
Who was she in Green Room, Nick?
She was the
witness?
Yes.
Yeah.
Was she in Civil War or Zootopia?
I don't think so.
What I'm saying is I don't see a lot of movies.
She was like Captain America's Shield.
Oh, I liked her in that.
Yeah.
She was great.
Yeah,
Unbreakable.
If you noticed, the shield was a little bit different this time.
I'm actually really happy they're going to do I Kill Giants as a movie. It's a great story.
Yeah. Okay. Ryan Potter, who played voiced Hero in Big Hero 6,
mm-hmm.
Did this video as a pitch to sort of Ben Affleck saying, And major credit, because he closes up by saying, like Tim Drake said, Batman needs a Robin.
Yeah.
That gets big credit for me. That's a great riff on a comic that is not necessarily super well-known. It's a 90s comic.
I mean, this wasn't exactly, like, super newsworthy in a sense.
But it's a fun video, and we'll put up a link to it.
Yeah, I didn't get around to seeing this.
This guy sort of, someone dressed like a Robin, like the We Are Robin costumes, essentially. And he's doing a big fight. He does pretty great fight
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, he does.
My only issue with it is... I want Robin to be more acrobatic, and this was more of a straight-up, like, martial arts fight.
It was.
I need Robin to be, like, hip-jumping around like a crazy person, like a
parkour kid.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. I thought it was a great video. It was fun. I did like the reference at the end.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think he's actually seriously thinking Affleck's going to cast him as Robin. But who knows?
I've seen weird things, and I actually saw somebody rendered him as Robin as a photo. It was really cool looking.
Remember when Sean Young wore a Catwoman costume on like one of the late night talk shows?
Letterman.
Everybody thought she was crazy.
Yeah.
Nowadays, no one would blink an eye.
Yeah, it's kind of true.
Every actor just does that. They put up YouTube videos. People Photoshop them in.
Yeah.
Yeah. About 10 years from now, everybody's going to put gonna put whatever actor they like in the movie, and they'll just photo, they'll just go ahead and put them in.
10 years
digitally.
From now, when the cloud explodes, we're just going to have Private Eye like costumes and hats that we wear.
That's
well, you
true.
Know, everything CG will be capable of completely lifelike recreations.
Yep.
So you will just be able to say, "Hey, digitally map my face onto whatever."
Yep.
And you will be able to cast yourself and anybody you know and anybody you could know.
If the trends continue, it's just going to be virtual reality everything.
So I need to be in a movie with Batman and Rick Deckard from Blade Runner.
Yep.
And Imogen Poots.
Because that name is great.
Because we need a shield in the movie.
We're all going to have holodex where all of this is going to be possible.
Yep. Interaction between people anymore.
I know.
And the population will fall off and we'll finally...
Or what was that comic called? Was it The Surrogates?
Surrogates, yeah.
Like touch human beings anymore because fear of disease or
no touchy.
Yeah.
And then they made that awful Bruce Willis movie.
Yep.
Oh, I forgot.
So did Bruce Willis. Bruce Willis wishes he could.
Bruce Willis has made plenty of Ben movies.
That's true. That's a lot of them.
Mercury Rising, I'm looking at you.
We have a couple of DC news, DC stories. One is that Booster Gold is not going to be in the DC Extended Universe.
Right. This is the Booster Gold movie. Is going to be kind of somehow its own standalone sci-fi superhero movie, presumably.
Now, here's the interesting thing about this to me. This was supposed to be a Booster Gold TV show. Do you guys remember this?
Right, I remember that. I didn't remember it, but I read it.
This is by Greg Berlanti.
Greg Berlanti is going to be directing the movie.
Greg Berlanti of, like, Arrow
Every,
and Flash
everything
and all
DC
that.
On TV.
Yep.
And so I think essentially what it was is he doesn't want to be involved in the DC Darkniverse.
Weakness.
Well, from what I understand, they're lightening it up now.
Yeah, well, that's the next story. But we'll get to that. Yeah.
Now,
but,
I will say this. To me, Booster Gold, without the DC Universe, is a bit of a dud as a concept. I'm not saying he can't pull it off.
Yeah.
But I really like the idea that he's from the Legion. Like, it's not the Legion.
Yeah, he's got a Legion flight ring.
Well,
yeah.
He stole it from the Time Museum.
Is he past them? Past Legionnaire?
No, he's prior to it, but because of the Legion time travels, there was a time bubble and all that
stuff. Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. I just like the playground of the DC Universe is so ripe for a time traveler.
Yeah.
See also an entire TV show that they've based on it, Legends of Tomorrow.
Here's my question.
Yeah?
Could you do a Booster Gold movie that's not the DC Extended Universe that still brings in the Legion and that kind of stuff? Because that's not the DC Universe either. That basically this becomes an alternate extended DC Universe, and therefore we get Greg Berlanti developing, kind of like the DC TV universe developed sort of by accident.
Yep.
That DC accidentally stumbles into a better version of their expanded cinematic universe.
If I were doing that, what I would have happen is he goes back in time to... pick up some tips and tricks or whatever, or coast on the coattails of this superhero that's lost to the historical records.
Yeah.
But they know inspired the Legion of Superheroes. He ends up becoming that hero.
I like that idea. I like that idea a lot. Here's the other thing.
Without the Legion, you still could do a good movie about a kind of crap ass egotist guy, or like loser dude from the future who comes back to the past and becomes the hero he needs to be.
Well, I mean, look at Guardians of the Galaxy for all that it is part of the cinematic universe. It doesn't really need to be. It's on its own.
Right.
So Booster Gold would be the same thing. I think it's possible. I also think that DC really desperately does not want to be Marvel. And if they really want to be, they want to have a shared universe, but they don't want to be Marvel. Having a shared multiverse is definitely different from Marvel.
Right.
If they have alternate worlds that could cross over later.
Like, what if Batman Who Brands People showed up on an episode of The Flash?
Yeah, sure.
The Flash is like, what the hell are you doing? And just knocks his ass out.
He's like, geez, I thought Arrow was bad.
Yeah.
I think this is stupid. I honestly, just put it in with the DC Universe. Have it be fun. I mean, regardless of what you said, Guardians of the Galaxy is part of the Marvel Universe because they definitely do all the world building. They do the Infinity Stones. So they're all going to sort of circle back. You can do your own thing, but have it connected, too.
I
just feel like it's completely dumb of them not to do it. If they're wanting to build the cinematic universe...
I don't think it's them. I believe this is Greg Berlanti saying, look, I don't want you guys enforcing your grimdark on my movie.
And I just don't see
why... I feel like they might cut a deal where Geoff Johns is like, come on, I'm gonna tone it down, and he'll be like, all
see,
right.
And that's what I expect Berlanti to do, is not so much cave, but he's not going to get his own universe.
All right, so let's jump onto this other story. Warner Brothers is, and this is a story that, I want to be clear, published September 8th, 2016. Warner Bros. Is responding to the criticism of how dark their cinematic universe is by saying, yes, we're going to lighten up. The reason I specify that is in September is because they've said that every year since Man of Steel came out.
And it
and it's never been true.
It's been as accurate as it was when they said they were going to lighten up Arrow.
I don't believe them for a second. I think this is what they know. They know what people want to hear. They say it, and then they do the opposite. I don't know what kind of thinking that is.
I believe it because it'll happen because, A, we already saw a taste of it with the Justice League trailer, and that went over well with people, and there'll be, like, more of that. Even if it leads to a kind of Frankenstein movie a la Suicide Squad.
Because Suicide Squad did have the laughs.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And then, but also because Geoff Johns is taking this active role in it.
Yeah.
So I do think they're going to do it. Whether it's successful is, of course, that's all gonna be way up in the air. But
well, this is Geoff Johns saying it.
Yeah.
Geoff Johns has shown no indication of being able to tone down darkness. In fact, he goes the other way in comics all the time.
Didn't he produce Flash?
He's involved in Flash. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think you know he can do those lighter moments. He's had it happen in his books. He does do darker books, but he. I don't think he's going to say you can't have these kind of serious scenes in it, but I imagine that less Batman branding of people,
probably more stuff
that's going to be like the kind of a little bit more of that Marvel sense of humor that honestly was on show for the Justice League trailer,
yeah.
The sizzle reel, whatever it was. I think the bad guys there might still be that kind of like higher death count. The bad guys might be pretty bad. But Randy, I'm going to put down my money and say that you're wrong on this and that there will be a lighter tone.
I would love to be wrong. But now, are you saying it's going to be a lighter tone like an actual lighter tone, or you mean by comparison to Batman v Superman? Because I don't know if that counts.
No, I think it'll be an actual lighter tone. I expect something of the Frankensteining that went on with Suicide Squad, where there's going to be some scenes where people are a little bit like, huh. You know, right after they showed that guy, you know, create a tidal wave and destroy half the city, you know, Cyborg's, you know, joking around with Flash. But it was a funny scene, you know, or I think it's going to be a little bit of that. That's my guess.
I will not be satisfied if Batman is still branding people. If that's the only change they made, if Batman doesn't brand people anymore, that's not enough for me.
You know, what's funny is I heard them say that they're going to somehow, in continuity, kind of explain that and kind of as a way of moving past it. Now, I'd kind of rather they just don't do it. Just don't do it. But I think, you know what I think they're going to do? Because like they had Apocalypse stuff going on in there, like weird premonition dream sequences with Batman.
Yeah.
I think they're going to say something like the coming of Darkseid or whatever was already creating this aura of fear over the world and that everybody was affected and then they can kind of use that as a blanket for like, oh, that's why Superman was kind of dour. That's why Batman was branding people.
That's why Pa Kent was such a jerk.
That's why Pa Kent was a jerk.
See, I don't think they're going to deal with the blanket thing. I think specifically for Batman that he was.
I just thought it'd be funny.
No, I think he was over the edge. He'd lost Robin. He'd lost a lot of things in his life.
But you think he'll do something like I've got to move back.
I think the Justice League will give him hope, and I think that's sort of what it's about.
You know, Batman's done. There's been a lot of things done to Batman in the comics. He lost Robin. I think more than once. He's definitely had, you know, things, tragedies, his back got broken. I don't remember ever branding people as a result. I think maybe that's just a misunderstanding of Batman. I think maybe Zack Snyder has only ever read Watchmen and thinks all comics should be like that.
Well, that may be, but I'm just saying with this particular iteration of Batman.
So, I think you're correct, Nick.
As long as we're making bets.
Well, you know, they also, you know, the Batman movies as presented by Nolan presented a Batman who aged and sustained injuries and stuff too, so they're playing in a different field.
And the Michael Keaton Batman killed people left and right.
So. Yeah, that's true.
he wasn't even like as pushed over the edge or anything.
No, he was just like I'm a bomb.
Weird guy.
I'm gonna drop a bomb.
You don't understand. Fine. My life is complicated. I have to go bomb this warehouse
full of people.
So, I will be super happy to be wrong about this. No one will be happier than me if DC managed to put out a movie that's
good. You don't
think
you'll be super happy to be cranky about it again?
Oh, I'll be cranky. I want to, as long as we're betting on this kind of thing, what do you guys think will be the first like DC success movie that will be not only financially successful, but will get reviews. Do you think Wonder Woman or Justice League?
I honestly think it's
what's first.
I honestly think Wonder Woman's first.
Oh, is it? For some reason, I thought Justice League.
No, Wonder Woman's first.
She's actually coming up this year. Is it early next year?
I think it's early next year. I'm not 100% sure.
I think Wonder Woman will probably be pretty big.
Yeah, I just think it'll have the humor. We've seen that in the trailer, but...
She's also got an iconic status. You know, where they were kind of hoping that the new Ghostbusters movie would draw in a very strong female audience.
Yep.
But there is not, like, a tradition of, like, of the Ghostbusters being a big thing for women.
Wonder Woman is literally
the biggest possible superhero. And even if people only like the t-shirts and, like, stuff that they have, they've never read a comic... They'll go see it.
Do you remember when we were taking bets in the lobby of Alamo of who would win?
Right,
Batman was going to win.
We were at the Alamo Draft House
Wonder
for Batman.
Wonder Woman's kicking butt.
Right, for Batman v Superman, and we created a little chart for people to choose who they thought was going to win, just kind of tongue in cheek. And Wonder Woman was on there, and what did you say?
I think she was second.
I think Batman only won because Batman.
Yeah, it's
Batman.
So, but see, that's a different question than what I'm asking. What I'm asking is, do you think this will be the movie that finally the critics like? Marvel has had a lot of luck. Critics like their movies.
Who's directing it?
It is Patty Jenkins, who did Monster.
Okay. I have no idea.
Maybe. Yeah, I'm not quite sure what her vision for Wonder Woman is. If it's anything like the trailer, I mean, we've seen that go different ways. I mean, you can make a good trailer without it being a great movie.
I mean, for the critics to like it, it has to be a good movie. And at this point, they do still have to prove themselves there and get a really good, solid, all-around movie. They've yet to do it. So I have no idea if they can pull that off.
See, and that's sort of my point, is that I think both Wonder Woman and Justice League are already lost causes, no matter how much lightening up they say they're doing, and that it's going to have to be whatever comes after that. Maybe Aquaman?
Like, you're 100% sure that they're going to be bad?
100% sure? No. Yeah. 95.
You don't think the director of Monster could maybe direct a good movie?
A good movie, yes. A good Wonder Woman movie, no.
Maybe not.
I don't think that's someone who can do a good Wonder Woman
movie. But let's also recall our skepticism about the Spider-Man directors... The total lack of knowledge on the Winter Soldier, not Winter Soldier, but the Civil War guy, the brothers.
The Russo brothers?
Russo brothers.
No, I was on board the Russo brothers because of Community.
Really? But you thought you saw Community and you're like, these guys are perfect for it?
No, but I had faith in them and I had faith in Marvel.
Yeah.
I thought Ghostbusters were going to suck because I don't like Paul Feig in general. I really love Ghostbusters.
But most people.
So I think it's possible that Wonder Woman's going to pull it out. But if I were a betting man, I'd put my money on it being another disappointment.
I think that's probably true, actually. I think that is a little bit more likely than not.
I will be the hopeful one and say Wonder Woman will be the one.
Yeah, but I don't feel like there's enough evidence. But mostly I'm in the I have no idea. It's conceivable. They have a talented director, but
and they have a talented Wonder Woman. They have a good cast. Yeah. It's just I don't know.
Looked good.
I don't know. I would like them to turn around because I really like the DC characters.
Let's see.
I would like to enjoy it as much as I'm enjoying the Marvel Cinematic. And I'm a Marvel guy. I always have been, and I'm always going to like Marvel a little more than DC. But I would sure love to love DC like I did in about the 90s. All right, the two anniversaries we're talking about. Is it the 25th anniversary of Batman the Animated Series, or was it 30th?
I thought it was 25th.
I think it's 25th.
Well, it debuted in 92.
So we're actually short of the 25th. That's what I thought. It was 92, right?
Unless it was like late 91.
They may be calling it 91, because I thought it was the 25th
anniversary. Maybe it was conceived then. Maybe they had... maybe On Leather Wings aired in December 1991 or something.
Well, if it was late 91, then we could be looking at 25th, because we are sort of late into 2016... I'm going to pull up Wikipedia here. It says 1992, November 1992, September 92. Their math is off. I thought we heard that it was 25 years. It's 24 years.
Is that Hallmark anniversary, the 24th year?
Let's celebrate the 24th anniversary of Batman the Animated Series. Well, we already planned for it, so we're going to do it. And we're going to talk about the show in general and give our sort of top five episodes. I had asked you guys. Sort of as we were talking about in the store, I'm like, what is the best Batman's animated series episode? And we couldn't really narrow it down to one.
Right. And, you know, one thing I noticed in talking about that is that although there are a few, ones that are just, everybody, loves that episode.
Yeah.
Right? There's a lot that are so, just rock solid, really good at what they're doing that I might not think of them as, the very best, but I'm like, I love that episode, you know?
Well, and some of our favorite episodes, as you'll see, are villain-focused.
Right.
Like, we're not talking about the ones like, this was the best, this is a great Batman episode.
Right.
No, this is a great Harley Quinn episode, this is a great Mr. Freeze episode.
And, you know, part of that is that the show, if there was one of its most defining qualities, was revamping the villains.
Yeah.
And giving some sort of tragic story at the heart of their narratives, so that they, almost to a man, had something to draw you in. Maybe true. Maybe not Maxi Zeus.
You know, Maxi Zeus was a crazy person. You got to feel a little bad for him.
Although, I just as a random aside, I was looking at people ranking all their stuff last night.
Yeah.
And the night before. That Maxi Zeus episode gets, like, pushed down to, like, the very bottom out of all of the 100-and-something episodes.
Below the Underdwellers?
Below the Underdwellers. The last one, unfortunately, was the Cool Hand Batman.
That's not unfortunate, Nick.
I actually have a fondness for Cool Hand Batman.
That's as may be, but...
Because I like Cool Hand Luke, and I mean, it's essentially the same story.
I have a fondness for Hudson Hawk, but...
I forget what it's called.
I think it's called
The Forgotten. Yeah, right.
They should have called it Cool Hand Batman, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a difference between fondness for and good.
Are you saying you would pick the Underdwellers over Cool Hand Batman?
No, I'm saying Underdwellers would be right below it. maybe not that harsh, but it's definitely not a good episode. Critters would probably go over it. At least that's fun.
What episode?
Critters, the one where the farmer's genetically enhancing farm life. Like,
I remember that being kind of watchable.
It is. It's very fun. It's Joe Lansdale.
Yeah. Oh, that's right.
But you know what I think that's probably the case is that the one you were saying was low. Was it Maxi Zeus?
Yeah.
A lot of people, what they liked about Batman the Animated Series, they liked this sort of this gritty Batman. It was like street crime and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it was weird. But
Mad
Greek God is like, they don't want to see Batman fighting a Mad Greek God. They want to see Batman fighting the Riddler.
You know what's funny is that I actually, they did some pretty out there stuff there. You know, they had Jonah Hex and in steampunk Old West with fighting Ra's al Ghul. I actually think that probably given a different writer and a little bit of thought, they could pull off a good Maxi Zeus episode.
Oh, sure.
Like, I feel like it's... Like, they can pull off just about anything. Actually, I saw some weird characters.
Maxi Zeus is not... We just turned up the other day. It's not a terrible episode.
No, it's not. But here's the thing. Not many people have pulled off a good Maxi Zeus story. I think that's Morrison true. Did with when his little Arkham Asylum.
Right, moment. He was super weird, creepy, electro-skeleton
but
guy.
Beyond that, I don't think there's been a great story with
Maxi Zeus. When was he created?
I don't know.
I mean, we should get onto the good episodes in a minute. But it's just, this is a little quick aside. I'm like, was he one of those Alan Grant ones?
He might have been.
Does he go back to like the 70s?
That feels like Alan Grant, because Alan Grant did some weird... Do you remember Joe Potato?
Yeah.
Joe Potato, the rat catcher. The Rat Catcher. Yeah,
but let's also not forget, he did create the Ventriloquist.
Yeah.
And some other good ones in there. And you know what? He was making a concerted effort to create new characters.
Yeah.
You know, he did use some of the older villains, but he was definitely trying to expand the stable, and at least a few of them stuck.
Well, one of the things the animated series did is that it would do it. It would bring in new villains, and it would bring in sort of weirdness. Like, the whole thing with Roland Daggett, the sort of corporate villain, he was fairly... I mean, we saw him mostly in Batman the Animated Series. He might have been in the comics. I'm not actually sure. But there was Roland Daggett.
What they did is sometimes they would take a guy who I think was, like, you know, had one story arc in the comics as, like, some corporate villain or whatever, and they're like, that's going to be our recurring guy.
And really expand on that character.
Yeah.
Yep. All right, so let's talk about our favorites. Dave, what you got?
All right, are we going in any particular order here?
No.
All right, well, because we were just talking about the Ventriloquist, I'm going to mention his origin episode, Read My Lips.
Mm-hmm.
It was written by Joe Lansdale, who people probably know is, or maybe don't know, local writer, very prolific. He's written horror and detective series. He did the Happen Leonard stuff.
Yep.
He wrote Bubba Hotep.
Yes, he did.
He wrote an amazing Jonah Hex horror series for DC Comics. Yep. He's done a ton of, you know, ton of kind of gritty horror novels and stuff with a Southwestern flair. Anyway, he's been in the business and he's written everything these days. But what I loved about the Ventriloquist episode is all these creepy little touches he does throughout. And I don't know how much of this was from the comics and how much wasn't. Like, when Batman first, he's investigating this, like, new crime lord or whatever, as I recall. A lot of these I'm a little blurry on, but... I remember that he records both the voice of Scarface, the dummy, and the ventriloquist, and, like, their patterns show that they're two different people.
Yeah.
Like, the computer can't tell that they're the same guy. And that's just a kind of cool, weird, creepy thing.
And if the bat computer can't tell.
There's also a bit where he's, like, sneaks into the ventriloquist's apartment to get some info, and the dummy is sitting there, like, on the bed.
Yep.
And Batman walks up to it, and he kind of, like, touches it, like, just... as if for just a second he kind of wonders if it might be alive, and its eyes flick open, and it's just those little Lansdale creepy touches, culminating, and of course it's just a crazy idea, by the way. This, as ridiculous as it is, I really like the idea, and he's a great new Batman villain that, you know, from Alan Grant. Of this guy who does all of his best thinking through his puppet. At the very end, Batman does his own voice throwing, I remember, and gets the ventriloquist to almost Scarface to point... have the ventriloquist points the gun of Scarface at himself because they get in a fight. And then eventually the doll gets flung, gets shot to pieces. We were talking about this the other day, Randy. If you ever seen Bonnie and Clyde, the big super violent end shootout, they do that with the dummy who at that point... Even if you know it's fake, you've invested a belief in his reality and the thing. So in this otherwise, you know, the show that always got away with a lot of surprisingly violent stuff, there's this horrific scene of this kid-like doll being shot to pieces. And it's still kind of startling to watch.
I mean, that sort of happens in the second Ventriloquist episode, too. I mean... Wesker actually shoots it himself. And,
They got their mileage out of robots and Clayface and stuff like that. They're like, we can kind of be violent with these. So anyway, that's Read My Lips is my first pick.
All right, Nick.
I think my first pick goes to
By the way, I should say mine aren't in particular order.
Mine neither. Yeah,
mine aren't either. But goes to a Poison Ivy story.
Okay.
I think she was one of my favorite villains on the show. I don't know why. I think it was just. Great voice acting, and...
It also did an interesting job of reinventing her as almost like a 40s-esque femme fatale.
Yeah.
And eco-terrorist, too. That was, you know... They had done stuff like that in the comics, but this was just a really good version of it.
It is. And the episode specifically that I'm talking about is one called House and Garden, where sort of Pamela Isley has been sort of reformed. She's married, has, like, two kids that are supposedly her husband's... kids from another marriage.
But things will take a horrific twist before the ending.
Very much so, because you know, around all this is the horrific, these giant green monsters that are sort of stealing things from I forget if they're like other, well, not Wayne Pharmaceuticals or things like that, but other corporations or something. Uh-huh. And Robin and Batman are investigating, fighting these colossal things that are sort of akin to, like, the Monster Men.
Yeah, they look like these weird giant, like, you'll eventually see, like, almost like cactus-like
or
something. Yeah,
they've got these weird green claws that are...
They're like talons, like a bear, as I recall,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they are. Yep. It's just a great look for them, great design work.
Yeah, I thought they were cool behemoths.
Yeah, and then sort of... Because Batman doesn't believe that Isley could reform, essentially, and he goes through, like, this chain of... Maybe she is reformed and going back and forth, being kind of conflicted.
Yeah, I just remembered, this is the episode that reveals in a kind of quiet way that she's infertile.
Yeah,
it does.
They did that in a very subtle way, but it's easy to pick up on. So where did those kids come from? Well,
I mean, and it's from plants. She's growing her own children.
Yes.
And in fact, aging them and making them turn into monsters to sort of do her bidding.
Yeah.
But... And here's the other twist, which I always loved, when I watched it again more recently, it came across even more so, is that, because when Batman is fighting Isley at the end, he finds out that, it's a copy of her. It disintegrates.
Oh, right.
And she's actually, like, on a plane. She was honestly happy about being married a little bit. She was sad that part of her was over. It was an interesting ending. It's sort of this twist, like, no, she actually was happy. And Batman sort of pushed her out of that comfort zone.
Right.
Even though she could never be completely good.
It's probably her most sympathetic episode, and it has all these weird kind of creepy takes
on
domestic
horrific.
Life.
It's horrific. I mean, but it's creepy as hell.
Yeah, they got into, like, some serious places in an episode about a woman creating plant babies.
That was the episode that made me buy the statue of Poison Ivy that they did years and years ago. It was beautiful off of that Batman animated series.
Well, that's one of the things the animated series did in general, was that they would do these takes on domestic bliss, whether it was Harley and Ivy, Joker and Harley, Baby Doll and Croc.
Yep.
There are any number, and then of course they do the stuff with kids, like Mojo, the invisible guy, and his daughter. Like, they definitely like to look at sort of the villain's family and give the villain's relationships.
Yep.
That brings me to mine is actually a classic. It's Laughing Fish. It is by Bruce Timm and Paul Dini, which is pretty much as classic as you get as far as the themes go. It is based on three comic books, all sort of Joker stories: Laughing Fish, Joker's Five Way Revenge, and The Joker Strikes Again, or something like that.
Yeah,
combines all those. It is the introduction of Harley Quinn. It has this great opening where this poor schmuck is driving down the road. No, that's actually I mix it up with the Joker's Revenge or whatever it is, where it's some poor guy who gets involved in it. But they decide he wants them to patent his Joker fish.
Right, he's poisoned like the bay, and these fish are coming up, and he goes to the patent office to like patent it.
Yeah.
By the way, one minor thing I remember from the Laughing Fish, and I had never seen this before. You know, they usually all had these like title cards and stuff like that. This one opened on that, like, dockside tavern or something like that, where they're about to, like, pull the fish, I guess, for the first time. And you just see, it's like a rainy day, and you see, like, the wooden sign for the tavern just blowing in the wind and creaking eerily.
Yeah.
And they just do a simple title, you know, white title face over it, not cutting to a title screen, but just the printed letters over the animation.
Yeah, that's right.
And it was really startlingly atmospheric. It was just like, I've never seen this in this in like a regular afternoon cartoon.
Right. And I don't think they did that other than that.
No, it was kind of a test thing. And they were always testing stuff, like when they began with by using black backgrounds to give it that noir feel.
Yeah.
Or they would paint, that is to say, they painted on already black paper.
This one also had Joker going after Bullock, and I loved their take on Bullock.
He was great.
He's this blustery guy. He doesn't like Batman, and yet you always liked him.
Yeah.
Always messy and eating donuts.
Yep.
Yeah.
There was one where somebody's, like, missing or whatever, and I still, like, quote this with my brother because we were just so amused because his first reaction, he's like, start dragging the bay. Like, he's like, let's start looking for where the mob buried this guy. It's such a classic Bullock line.
I think my favorite part of that Laughing Fish is the commercial that Joker and Harley
made. Oh, yeah.
It's just hilarious. Sort of him expounding on the fact that you should eat my Joker fish.
Yeah, well, and it calls to mind one of my favorite things from the Batman, the Keaton Batman movie, where Joker interrupts to do an ad for Smilex.
Yep. Yeah, it's still great a little bit. Did Harley get much time in that one, or were they still figuring her out?
She sort of twirls into the patent office, actually. And
okay.
She's the one who sort of presents the thing at the Joker. She's basically there presenting the Joker.
She's his hype man?
Yeah, she's his hype man.
I believe she tells Joker when... she does not like fish.
Yeah, that's right.
And he's like,
during the commercial, she tells him she's allergic. And then he still makes her eat, and then she throws up off camera.
Yeah.
All right, Dave, what else you got?
All right, let's see. Let me jump to, I think this might have been when it became like the new Batman Adventures.
Okay.
Legends of the Dark Knight.
That is indeed the new Batman Adventures.
People will perhaps remember this as the... almost Rashomon-esque story of, three kids hanging out and swapping stories.
Three kids, all of whom sort of represent, like, the one of the kids is Joel. He's not one of the actual kids telling the story.
Right,
They took a shot at sort of Joel Schumacher because they sort of made fun of his take on Batman.
But each one of them has a different vision of Batman, and that's kind of like a late in the episode gag. But otherwise, they all represent very kind of like honored eras. There's one that's like the Golden Age Batman.
Bill Finger.
With all its kind of giant props. And by the way, I still thought that Joker was kind of creepy, though, the voice they gave him.
Yeah. That's the Dick Sprang one, actually.
Dick Sprang. And then there's, and you know, it's like, oh, my dad was a security guard. I remember somebody's talking about how grim Batman is, and he's like, no, my dad's a security guard. Batman saved him. He says Batman's real nice.
Yeah.
You know? And then they cut to this. And then, of course, I forget what's the middle one. Is it like the actual Batman? I know the other one is the Dark Knight.
Before
they would ever get... When I never conceived that they might adapt Dark Knight Returns,
I think
this had a snippet of it.
I think, the one that we're talking about, Bill Finger and Dick Sprang are sort of referenced in the one that's like the security guard where he's like sort of the smiling Batman and there's a museum full of giant props and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then there's the Dark Knight. And then they meet the actual Batman when he takes on Firefly.
Right.
I forgot it was Firefly. That was sort of the...
And along the way, they run into kind of a weird, goofy kid who, like, is clearly supposed to be a Joel Schumacher riff.
It's borderline homophobic.
It is a little bit, He's supposed to be... He's a little bit fey and effeminate. And he's talking about his weird kind of fetishy vision of Batman.
Yeah.
It was funny at the time. Yeah, now it feels a little homophobic.
Yeah.
It's still kind of a funny jab, though.
Yeah.
Just that they would do it in their own show and not just like in the writer's room goofing around. But anyway, a just a super fun, what was cool about it is that it nodded to all those different eras without, like, knocking any of them down, except for Joel Schumacher, sorry. Well,
I remember how The Dark Knight Returns being animated was such a huge deal at the time. Well, we're going to see
and
that.
By the way, and it was the scene where Batman takes down the mutant leader.
It was the perfect one to do.
Yeah, it was like the ultimate Batman is hardcore scene.
Yep. The funny thing is, when they did the animated Batman Dark Knight, I liked it, but I think they did a better job on the animated series where it was just a little vignette. Yeah.
All right, Nick, what's your next pick?
I think you always have to choose a Joker story. I mean, Randy chose Laughing Fish, which is
amazing. I agree. That's one of the reasons Laughing Fish made my list.
Mine would have to be Joker's Favor, which is a fun little one about a poor schlub. Why am I blanking on the guy's name?
I don't remember, but
I think it's Charlie. If I'm not mistaken.
It is Charlie Collins.
And this poor schlub of a man runs afoul of the Joker.
Well, the Joker's driving.
Right.
And he, like, cuts him off or something, and he yells at him. And then he looks, he's like, oh my god, I just yelled at the Joker.
And I feel like Joker, like, pushes him off the road.
Yep.
And, like, gets him and gets his driver's license.
Yep. And he says, you're gonna have to do me a favor.
And do you a favor. And I think Charlie goes kind of... not crazy per se, but he definitely fears for his life, changes his name, changes where he lives.
Yep.
And then I forget what scheme Joker is doing. I think it's against the mayor,
It's 2 years later, and he's using Charlie to sneak a bomb into a club where Commissioner Gordon is giving a speech, an award ceremony.
And I think...
all he has to do is open the door.
Yeah, well, I think... and yeah, after changing his name, Joker finds him easily.
You know what, Nick? This is the debut of Harley Quinn.
Oh, it is?
I thought it was Laughing Fish, but it says here on Wikipedia, this episode features the debut of Harley Quinn.
Oh, okay.
We learn something every day.
Yeah. Yes. No, but yeah, basically the favor is to open a door. And I think this kind of baffles Charlie in a lot of ways. He's like, all I have to do is open a door?
Yeah.
Of course, this being the Joker, that's all you have to do, but then you have to die, essentially.
Yeah.
But I think it's what's interesting is that... Charlie ends up standing up for himself.
He does.
In a little bit of a crazy way, but he stands up against the Joker, stands up for himself, and it's a fun thing because Joker, in a sense, backs down in a lot of ways. He's frightened of seeing this same man go crazy.
Right.
Which is just a fun little turnaround for the Joker. Mark Hamill, of course, does an amazing job. Batman shows up, but honestly, he's kind of a bit player in the episode. Mm-hmm. Where in a lot of episodes he kind of is a bit player.
They do that sometimes where the story is about the effect. I mean, it's kind of what Gotham Central will do later where it shows the effect of Batman, but Batman is barely in it.
I mean, plenty of episodes totally focused on him.
Sure.
But some of the best ones only use him sporadically.
It's true. And sometimes he's kind of the deus ex machina, the heavy you drop at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just thought, I'm surprised that this one is Harley's first episode because she doesn't get used much, just sort of some framing devices, and she's like, I think a conversation with the Joker about Charlie. But, interesting. I love that episode.
So you mentioned the Batman episodes where he's like barely in it.
Yeah.
And the one I want to talk about is one of my favorites that we had to make our list. Things on all of our lists really is Almost Got Him. Which is another Paul Dini episode, by the way.
One of the most favorited episodes, I would imagine.
Only reason it's not on my list, because I knew it was on your list.
Yep. So, this is influenced by a four-issue story arc in Batman titled Where Were You on the Night Batman Was Killed? In this one, there's Catwoman, Lex Luthor, Riddler, and the Joker recounting their claims to have killed the Batman.
Aren't they, like, playing poker?
No, that's in the comic story, is Catwoman, Lex Luthor, Riddler, and the Joker. In the show, Joker, Killer Croc, the Penguin, and Two-Face, and Poison Ivy are meeting and playing poker, and they're all telling a tale of the time they almost defeated Batman.
I love it. I love when all the bad guys get together. It's
right. It's that fun kind of rogues hangout sort of thing. Yeah.
And the fun thing is, the big reveal at the end is that Croc was actually Batman the whole time.
Right.
Batman was disguised as Croc.
He was infiltrating because he needed to get one of them to tell their story, which was recent,
because
it had a clue to, like, what was
Harley
going
Quinn
on.
Was trying to kill Catwoman.
Oh, right.
Because Catwoman rescued Batman, so he needed to find out where Catwoman is and rescue
She's
her.
She's, like, in this death trap.
Yeah.
But, man, does he make Killer Croc look stupid?
Poor Killer Croc. When it comes to his turn, he's like, I hit him with a rock one time.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's even funny when you realize
everybody has been doing their kind of grandiose, you know, the Penguin has his aviary of doom.
Yes.
Which I always remember he had a giant cassowary. which I didn't even really know what that was, but it's a big ostrich-like bird that he's outfitted with, like, poison-tipped claws.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, when Batman's fighting it, it actually looks kind of threatening. Like, it kicks him in the chest, and, you know, you see, like, those blood
Birds
scratches.
Are fighting.
I've been attacked by a goose. I know this. I know it.
But the interesting thing about this, too, is that Harley Quinn is about to kill Catwoman because she rescued Batman. And this sort of ties into something we noticed, is that Harley Quinn is the most successful villain that Batman has. She gets a drop on him, like, 3 or 4 times.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Mad Love, distinctly, yep. In this. I forget what the other one
There was
were.
Another one.
One where the Batman is on trial.
In the trial,
in
she and Poison Ivy take him down.
Yep.
And then, of course, Holiday Nights, where they kidnap Bruce Wayne.
Yep.
So, Harley Quinn, the most successful Batman villain ever.
It's true.
I love when they drop Bruce Wayne down the elevator shaft.
Yeah, they're like, oh, we were going to kill him anyway.
Oh, we were going to kill him.
Yeah.
Dave, what else on your list?
Lest Harley and Ivy be relationship goals, let's remember that just like the Joker, they're maybe not the nicest people.
They really aren't.
So the one I'm going to mention is one I need to see again to sort out all the details. But I remember the distinct elements of it, and this is also from the New Adventures of Batman, Growing Pains.
Yeah.
This is a Clayface episode.
It's creepy.
That, yes, begins, it's a mystery that slowly unfolds into this very creepy finale. There's a little girl in it, I remember, and I think she's like amnesiac.
Yep.
And she's being chased by, like, these goons, and Robin saves her, yeah. And he kind of, like, forms, like, a little, like, a crush on her,
yeah.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, there's, like, somebody else, like, this kind of big brute guy who's terrorizing Gotham City, they're going on these crime sprees. And eventually, of course, what the episode will reveal, which there was no hint of early on,
yep.
They find this residue, like, in, like, or what, maybe places she's been or whatever,
yep.
Is that she was actually a splintered off portion of Clayface's own body. Given, like, did he just sort of will the sentience into her?
Yeah,
he
was using her to scout the city.
Okay, he created a kid to kind of be just a lookout, right?
Yeah.
Like sort of like a little kid thief.
Yeah.
Only what he got like fought Batman or got separated from her, and
yeah.
She kind of that's
from
when
their
she,
own sentience.
Yeah, she began to be like
yeah.
like the replicants in Blade Runner kind of became her own thing. So at the very end of the episode, in a really horrific moment, Clayface reabsorbs her.
Well, doesn't she sacrifice herself to save Robin?
I feel like maybe so, but he intentionally takes her, draws her back into.
He's trying to get her. Well, he's trying to get her to not do it,
right?
And she wants to go back, basically,
right? And at that point, her sentience dissolves essentially into him. And I remember kind of, you know, Batman and Robin are just sort of grimly, you know, planning to, I guess they take him down, he's like, and they're like, Robin is saying that they need to up the charge to not just thievery, but like murder one.
Yeah.
Because effectively he killed that girl. And this is another one of those cases where they got around these sort of normal rules of what they could show.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, Clayface kind of killed a kid in this
yeah.
episode. It's just that he did it in such a weird roundabout way that they can kind of say, well, he kind of didn't.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he kind of did. Anyway, so one of those disturbing-y kind of episodes. Nick, what you got?
I want to talk about a Mad Hatter episode.
Okay.
Because he gets kind of the shaft in a lot of things. He's not the greatest villain.
Nope.
But he's had some good bits.
He has. He's got a fantastic look, too.
Yep.
They did such an amazing job in the animated series with him. But poor Jervis Tetch.
They actually, by the way, gave him... Is this his origin one?
It's not.
Because they did give him a sympathetic thing where he...
Oh, he's extremely sympathetic, and if not a little crazy.
Was he kind of like a professor who was like everybody picked on, and there was like one nice girl named Alice who kind of looked out for him?
But she was involved with somebody else, and basically he wanted her with him, so
right.
Of course invented
he's
this
the ultimate spurned guy.
Yep.
But the one I'm... Oh, go ahead, Randy.
It reminds me of the Riddler from Gotham, actually.
Who's
like
the Gotham
constantly,
TV show.
Constantly pursuing this woman who, she's nice enough to him, but she has no interest in him.
Right.
Yeah.
But the episode I want to talk about is the Perchance to Dream episode,
yes.
Which sort of purposes the question of Bruce Wayne had everything right in his life, sort of like what Superman had when the Black Mercy was attached to him.
Right.
Although this wasn't going to kill Bruce, this was just
right.
going to keep him in this weird loop of
like
an alternate
comatose
reality.
Loop. Yeah, like a Matrix thing.
But his parents were alive, he was about to marry Selina Kyle, however, he could remember his past and everything he felt was wrong. There was a Batman that was running around saving people, and just he couldn't accept it, and that was sort of the acceptance was what Mad Hatter felt like anybody would do.
Yeah,
and of course his non-acceptance of it is the thing that broke him out of the.
Is that the one that at some point where he says that you can't read in dreams?
Yes.
And because he realizes that the letters he's looking at are kind of gibberish.
Yeah.
But he perceives them, and he realizes that then it has to be a dream.
Yeah, and of course it just illustrates how badass Batman is, because I think when he breaks out, Jervis is like, no will could ever break the yeah. thing of my machine. And it's like, no, Batman can.
You know what's interesting? The Mad Hatter himself isn't always the most compelling villain, but his kind of mind control tech has been used in a lot of really cool ways.
Yeah, it's true.
So he ends up still being in some good stories.
Yep. Yeah. Now, I like the character and I liked the episode a lot. It was a lot of fun.
It's a good one to put Bruce Wayne to the test. Yeah. You know? Randy?
My next one is Beware the Grey Ghost, which is a Simon Trent, an actor best known for playing the Grey Ghost on TV. Sells his merchandise off, and there's a series of crimes that start up. So Batman has to team up with his inspiration and idol, voiced by Adam West, who is playing the Grey Ghost. And basically, it's like Batman and the other Batman teaming up.
And he was supposed to be like a 40s serial, almost more like the old Batman series.
They made him cooler, yeah.
Yeah, not like campy, like...
No.
Aren't the things happening like toy cars that are actually used as explosives?
Yep. But yeah, it's the bad guy's like a mad bomber.
Yeah.
And the bad guy's sort of forgettable, but what's notable about it is the team up. Yeah, yeah, and it's really good. And the Grey Ghost is a fun character.
And also you see clearly that the Grey Ghost was like an inspiration to young Bruce Wayne as far as like becoming a crime fighter and all that stuff. So it's got this sort of warmth to it.
Sort of working with a mentor type thing.
Yeah, yeah. And even as it's like tipping the hat to the 60s Batman.
The Grey Ghost is also a great design.
It's cool.
It's not...
He's like a pulp hero.
Yeah, it's not a super weird... I mean, it's just he's got a trench coat and goggles and
it's
a hat.
It's shadow ass.
But it's...
Some kind of guns? Did they just make...
Like a grappling gun, I think. Yeah, the mist guns. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But yeah, it was a cool design and a fun episode, so... Dave, what else you got?
I did these sort of in a bad order because I also had another Clayface episode in here, Feet of Clay.
Yep.
I'm cheating and including episodes, parts one and two.
Yep.
What's really notable about this is that Clayface at the time in the comics, I remember there were four Clayfaces.
Yep.
Through that they had just accumulated all this kind of continuity baggage over the years.
And one of them is this weird guy. He doesn't even have the shape-changing powers. He was like in a suit and his clay made people dissolve.
Right.
It was like they were weird
Clayfaces.
And then
there was the original one from like the Golden Age Batman who was just like an actor.
Yeah.
Who was just like kind of a murderous actor guy. So they kind of merge. And, you know, like you see Clayface anywhere now. Video games, comics, anywhere. It became the animated series one where they kind of took the best of everything. They created this guy who's kind of like a washed-up actor who, as I recall, is having to... He's a little past his prime, and he's taken, like, this experimental formula to kind of keep his youthful looks, right?
Yeah, he was disfiguring a car accident.
Right.
And Roland Daggett
is
giving him a monthly supply of an addictive face cream known as Renew You.
Yep. And he has to... You see early on this thing where he's, like, kind of, like, almost pushing his face into place to get the look he wants... And is Daggett extorting him and like forcing him to commit crimes?
He frames Bruce Wayne to try for the attempted murder of Lucius Fox.
Oh, that's right.
And it was not Bruce Wayne. It was Matt Hagen who failed to murder him.
Right,
and then
Matt
Daggett
Hagen is our new face.
And Daggett says, "Okay, well, we're not gonna give you the Renew You anymore." And Hagen breaks into Daggett's lab. They gets caught and they like basically force him to swallow liters of the formula to avoid drowning.
Right,
it's really pretty gruesome.
Yeah, that like the composition of Clayface's body is this kind of nasty brownish goop.
Yeah,
and it culminates in the second part in this very like if you've ever seen Terminator 2.
Yeah,
these amazing transformation sequences as Batman takes on a guy who's way stronger than he is. He's like this brute, you know, like the more or less, almost like Batman fighting the Hulk at times.
Right.
And he turns his weapon, his arms and into weapons and stuff. There's a part where he's fighting on they're fighting on like a subway train. And I remember this little girl is watching Matt Hagen like melt. And she's like, man, mommy, you know, what's wrong with that man's face?
Yeah.
And you see his face melting and, you know, Batman catches up with him then. Batman knocks him to the ground, and he, like, reverses himself, as we've seen the T2 do, where his, like, you know, his back, his face is suddenly emerging from his back. And he's doing all those kind of weird tricks where, like, Batman will pull a punch, throw a punch that he grabs or, like, hits his chest.
Yep.
And then it turns his, you know, into, he reemerges with his hand from his chest, holding Batman in place. And in the violent finale to it, Batman is actually absorbed inside Clayface's body to suffocate him, where he uses his grapple gun to pop out, blowing, like, Clayface's head open.
Yep.
Really pushing the edges of what I think they could show. And then ultimately Clayface, who can dissolve in water, gets knocked into the sea in this rather terrifying dissolving sequence.
Yep.
Wasn't that the end of the first one, or part of it? And the second one, I just remember the, like, the monitors with all the different versions of characters that Hagen had played.
The second one is about him falling apart.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the first one was mostly Batman tracking down this guy who had, like, framed him or whatever.
Yeah.
And the
yeah.
second one was, like, it was the FX one.
Yeah.
It was, that was when he cut loose. He used all his powers, and they did an amazing job animating it and created a visual that became the characters we know it.
You know what's interesting? For as much as we remember all this, I'm looking through, and Clayface is only in 4 episodes. If you count this two-parter as one, he has Mudslide later in the season, which is him falling apart. He's in the Holiday Nights episode, where actually he does create, like, little versions of himself, urchins, to go and rob the place, which is a presaging of what's going to happen with the little girl.
Yeah.
And then the one that you talked about, the... Growing Pains. That's his last episode of the show. He's in 4 episodes, and yet, it's such a defining version of the character.
Yep. Well, you know, Harley isn't actually in that many episodes herself, and yet defining version.
Yeah.
I mean, not just defining, originated there, and has gone on to become one of the most popular characters in all of comics right now.
Yep.
Not just in Batman, but in comics.
Yeah, it's true.
Nick?
I want to talk about the Clock King.
Yeah?
It's name of the episode, Clock King.
Not a villain people normally say, I love the Clock King.
No, and no one says that.
But, I mean, he had a sort of defining episode. You know, it was basically, he was this
It's a perfect example of taking a kind of a nothing character and making him cool.
Yeah, because I think his origin, wasn't he like a... Did he work for Wayne?
He was like some accountant or
some accountant.
He worked for Mayor Hill.
Right.
Yeah, he wanted to kill the mayor.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, his whole beef with the mayor is that the mayor told him to... take a break from his everyday plan.
Yeah,
he was so wound up.
Take a 5-minute sort of breather, and because of that, he lost all of the information he was supposed to give to the
judge. Right, he has this bad turn of events, can't make it someplace on time, and everything goes wrong.
So time becomes his sort of, his modus operandi of, and he knows everything down to the T. I love how he faces Batman and sort of uses the subway system against him and as a route of escape.
Yeah, this guy who's just kind of a sort of a nerdy dude in a bowler hat, you know, not unlike a Riddler type.
Yep.
But he manages to kind of hold his own against Batman because he can just, like, get out of anywhere because he knows where it's like he's figured out where everything in the city is going to be.
Yeah. I mean, he's just another one of those characters that you don't think would give Batman much of a problem.
Right.
But it's the smarts that sort of can really lead to some interesting fights.
They would later go on to do a really awesome follow-up episode, by the way, where
is that the Batmobile episode?
Could slow down time and, you know, warp it and stuff, and they did a bunch of cool stuff with that.
They did.
But yeah, even as a powerless dude, he was awesome in this. I like the guy who voiced him.
Yep.
He had that kind of nebbish but threatening sound.
If I'm not mistaken, and correct me if I'm wrong, Randy, isn't the same guy who voiced him in the Justice League Unlimited episodes?
Yes, I believe so.
Where he is actually part of the Suicide Squad.
Well, I was going to say, this is his only episode in Batman.
Well, there was one follow-up in, like, New Adventures.
Was there? Because I didn't see it.
When he basically...
Or maybe not even New Adventures. Yeah, it's the one where he actually has powers.
Where he puts a device on the Batmobile and sort of...
knocks it out of sync with time?
Yes.
Huh.
Yeah, he actually... And he's committing crimes by, like, stopping time.
Yeah, it's pretty
awesome.
So
he would go on to be, actually effectively have powers.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was looking. I was like, maybe I just missed it.
But... Yeah, no, I think he only had 2 episodes in the series, and then, whatever was in
Yeah, you're right. Time Out of Joint is the other one.
Yeah. But it just stood out as one of my favorite episodes.
Yep, I remember seeing that early on when they were originally
glasses
airing.
Are little timepieces
yep.
or something.
Yeah,
it's just the subtle little details for his design. Randy, what is your next one?
Harlequinade. Joker steals an atomic bomb. Batman has to do a team-up with Harley Quinn.
Does this have the scene in it where they're driving in the Batmobile, and she's like... locked up or whatever, and he's like, behave yourself, and she's like, I want to listen to the radio.
Yes, I want to listen to the radio,
and she almost starts pressing buttons that, like, you know, turn on the jet engines and parachutes and all that.
Yeah. Yeah. There's also the thing where she's like coming up behind him. She's like, sneak, sneak, sneak. He's like, shut up. Batman having to work with Harley Quinn is just so good. It also has the singing where she goes to the club
and does
the torch song.
Yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah, all the mob guys are watching her doing the like hot under the collar sort of thing. Does this by chance have, is this the one or is that the other one where Robin does the nunchuck fight with the fish?
This is that one as well.
Cause that was always super awesome. Cause the actual fight scene is cool, but it's basically like a Jackie Chan kind of riff where it's ridiculous because he's fighting with fish at like a fish vendor kind of
thing.
This is also
the one that has Harley giving sort of a comeuppance to the Joker because she finds out he was going to leave her in Gotham with a nuclear bomb.
Right.
And so she does this thing where she's like, eat this, puddin'.
Yeah.
And it's like, you don't ever see her stand up for herself against the Joker, and it's kind of nice to see.
Yep.
So I love this episode. It is my favorite Harley episode. There is also the one where it's Harley's day off, which I like a lot, and I always think that some of that stuff happened, but this one was my favorite.
And I did save my overall favorite for last.
Me too.
It is the one that, the episode that turned me around on the show. I had actually been kind of ignoring it for a little while when it first came out. I did not watch On Leather Wings. Actually, I might have watched that and thought, well, that was better than I thought, but I think I let the rest slip past me, and they did have some mediocre episodes early on. Now, I remember one afternoon I randomly watched Heart of Ice.
Yeah.
The first appearance of Mr. Freeze, who would only himself have like maybe two later episodes, I think.
Right.
And it was the first time I had ever seen any sort of action-adventure cartoon that was like not anime really evoke pathos the way it did. Mm-hmm. Because if ever there was a character that they really injected some sympathy for, it was Mr. Freeze. You know, everybody seems to have like lost a loved one or something, but... Man, I gotta say, I think the voice acting of Michael Ansara as Mr. Freeze has really just sold this episode so hard. Yeah, I mean, who can forget it? It's like almost chill-inducing. Whoa, see what I did there? Not intentional. But I remember reading and or hearing from behind the scenes stuff that they had to tell the actor Michael Ansara, who's kind of a genre actor who'd been around in Hollywood for decades. To keep bringing it down, you know, not play it too Dr. Doom and larger than life, that they needed to restrain himself as if he's dead to emotion, which, of course, was the conceit of the character, that his heart was frozen, basically. Like, if you only know the Arnold Schwarzenegger ridiculous version from Batman and Robin, you got to see this, because this is everything that the character could be.
Yeah.
And aside from that, there's also, like, some great action sequences in it. When Batman goes up against him in the end... It's the first time he's fighting him, and he kind of like comes onto the scene and he does this leap, and it goes into a roll, and then he like double foot kicks Freeze, and it like knocks him way the hell off balance. And then like even as he's kind of just starting to get his balance, Batman's already up and like swinging punches at him, and they're just like kind of glancing off the helmet and his chest plate and stuff, but you can tell they're impacting hard, and it's nothing to Freeze. And he does this cool thing where Batman does a kick, and he catches it and flings him away, and only then does he explain that his suit also gives him enhanced strength and stuff like that. So they made him a physical threat, not just a guy who has that cool freeze gun.
Yep.
He did kind of some cool stuff that's a little bit larger than life, like he kicked over a fire hydrant in it, put the freeze gun in it, and just pulls the trigger, and then like rides the ice arc
Iceman
up.
Style.
Yeah, yep. Up to like the top of a building. Great visual design on Freeze, cool fight scene, and the unforgettable ending of Freeze, you know, in Arkham apologizing to his wife's, the little snow globe, that she has for not being able to, you know, like be worthy of her or bring her back. So, and amazing music by Shirley Walker. I don't know if we've mentioned this,
We didn't.
The music.
She's, you know, truly phenomenal. So many great moments in all those episodes. And this one was for sure one of the standouts for me.
By the way, this is another Bruce Tim Paldini episode.
Yeah.
And it won the 1993 Daytime Emmy for Outstanding Writing in an Anime Program.
Oh, wow. I did not know it won an Emmy. So that's my that's my last one. Nick,
my last
close
one,
it out.
It was probably a favorite of mine growing up, and that is The Heart of Steel, Part 1 and 2.
So would you call this your number one? Is this your favorite Batman episode?
I guess it might be, and I don't know exactly
why. It's an off-kilter choice, because that's not a classic villain by any means.
No, I mean, I don't think... Has Hardak ever appeared in a comic book?
I don't think Hardak has ever been in a comic book.
They should change that, honestly. They should bring that into the mythology.
Because I felt like this had some horror elements, most definitely, because it had sort of Invasion of the Body Snatchers type feel. It has some Blade Runner
feel. For people
feel.
Who haven't seen it, it's like, it's a supercomputer.
It's a supercomputer that basically is replicating people and putting them in, making copies of people. Yeah. And
there's a not-so-subtle homage to Blade Runner in multiple ways. The replicants of Blade Runner become duplicants.
Yes.
And they had the same, the voice actor of the creator of Hardak is the guy who was J.F. Sebastian.
Yeah, yes. Carl Rossum is played by, oh man, I'm blanking on his name.
I know,
name
we
now.
Always blank on this guy's name. And
William Sanderson.
William Sanderson.
Yeah.
And
a great character actor.
Which is an amazing voice to have for your episode. Yeah. Hardak is just a fun villain, and it's sort of the scene where Gordon gets replaced, and she's with he's with Barbara, and she almost instantaneously recognizes that there's a problem, and she goes off to investigate, and there's just some really cool moments in here, and
there are like these Terminator level fights with the robots in the end, which also have one of those, oh wow, the animators got to cut loose with the violence.
Well, and the sort of spider like movements of like the Gordon robot.
Oh yeah, there's some startling things when they change and they start moving in these really weird ways.
Yeah.
Or their arms will be backward or something like that. I remember at some point, like, in the end, like, Batman, like cuts loose an elevator on one of them.
Yeah.
Like, plummets and crunches one of them.
Well, when you realize these aren't actual people.
Yep, then it's time to start crushing
and the people that they've replaced are in sort of, like, these vats of keeping them alive.
Matrix
because
vats,
Hardak must, you know, analyze to see exactly what makes them tick.
It's a more sci-fi plot than you usually get for Batman.
It is.
But it shows how I think an occasional change-up, like Batman in space, is maybe pushing that a little too far sometimes. But Batman versus creepy robots, we can work with that.
Yeah, I remember the scene where basically Bruce's love interest is sort of an agent of Hardak, a replicant. And
you
so
mean a duplicate?
A duplicate, whatever.
Completely different.
And she's dispatched to Wayne Manor to basically figure out, I think Bruce is supposed to have some sort of information that wasn't on the Wayne Industries servers.
Uh-huh.
And she breaks into the Batcave after subduing Alfred, which we haven't mentioned yet, but the person who does voice act Alfred was amazing.
Yeah, from Zimbalist Jr. Yeah.
One of the.
So good.
Well, probably the quintessential classic Alfred.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think she finds the Batcave and everything, and Hardak is like, we will put this information to good use, or, it's creepy.
The voice of Hardak was awesome. I don't even know who did the voice for Hardak itself,
no
but,
idea.
You know, it was very much a HAL 9000 kind of thing, and, you know, he had that same, you know, even, like, the single red eye, like, you know, as an homage to HAL, so they riffed on a lot of evil robot stories.
So, no, my favorite episode isn't, like, Robin's Reckoning or anything. It's a weird sci-fi Batman story.
Before we get to my favorite story, I want to mention, we didn't ever bring up Milo, Professor Milo.
Yeah.
He's only in two episodes, Scratch Fever and the werewolf episode, but he was a weird addition. The whole, it was like a mad scientist who Batman ran across.
Yep.
It felt more like old school Batman, like 60s
Monster
Batman.
Man,
yeah.
Batman, you think?
There were some
new
villains.
You know,
there.
I've been playing that Arkham Underworld app.
Yeah.
I'm still playing that. It's actually still really fun. And Milo is in there, and he.
Really?
Yeah, he has a lab. He has a lab, and occasionally gives you. Essentially, new stratagems that you can use that kind of allow you to do special things when you attack places. But it's like you can also, at this point, I steal isotopes that he uses to build into compounds to amp up my dudes and stuff like that.
It's crazy.
And he's also who you go to when you want to, like, train your villains. It's like they'll get new powers and stuff through his labs.
That's interesting. I would assume that guy was gone forever.
Yeah, he must have shown in, like, the Arkham games at some point. Because
I don't remember him.
I don't know. And they've got a model that looks just like the rest
of
the Arkham
weird.
Stuff. But, yeah.
Okay, my favorite episode is a new Batman adventure. It's called Over the Edge.
Yeah.
And Nick was watching this the other day, and you didn't think you'd seen it.
I hadn't, actually.
Wow.
So, Over the Edge.
Did you enjoy it?
I did, very much so.
I love Over the Edge, and I'm reluctant to give away the big ending, actually.
Why don't you say how it begins?
Okay, so it starts with the cops are after Batman and Robin. He is,
Like, you don't know why at
you
first.
Don't know why,
they're
but, like...
tracking them down, but it sounds like they're going to, like, shoot to kill.
Well, and they know it's Bruce Wayne.
Oh, right.
Like, they're surrounding the Batcave and Wayne Manor, and they're, like, they have... There's this thing where, like, they get on the Batboat, and they're driving away, and the police are chasing them. Nightwing has to distract them, and Nightwing gets arrested.
Yep.
And this whole crazy thing is going on, and, I mean, it gets so desperate that Gordon actually hires Bane to take Batman down.
Right.
And it is revealed that Scarecrow, there was a thing going on with Scarecrow, and that Batgirl got basically knocked off the building, knocked to her death.
Right. This is one of the most horrific scenes of the series.
And Gordon, like, sees her. She lands on her car.
He's driving, and there's, like, the top of his car dents in.
Yeah.
And it's his daughter's body.
Yeah, because he goes out, and she says, "Dad." It's like her last final words. Because he didn't know it was her.
Oh, right.
And he finds out that Batman had let his daughter into this sort of crime fighting world.
Super personal.
And there's a twist. I don't reveal it, but it leads into this very sweet scene between Batgirl and Gordon, which makes it very obvious that her fear is based on that Gordon and Batman might come to blows because of him not knowing about her identity as Batgirl, and she wants to tell her father.
Right.
And her father basically says, like, "You don't never need to tell me anything." And it's very cleverly implied that Gordon knows both who Bruce Wayne is and who Batgirl is.
Right.
And that he doesn't need to know. He doesn't need them to tell him.
Right.
That he can keep that at a distance, that he loves them both regardless. And he actually says, like, "I love you both regardless."
I was going to say, it's sort of an as you wish kind of scene.
Yeah, and it's great. And it's not only for, I mean, of course he loves his daughter, but to indicate how strong his feelings are toward Batman.
Right.
That this could never happen the way it goes down. And it's really, really good. And it's just, I mean, beyond just, it's always fun to see the sort of the desperation and things like, "Oh, I can't believe this is happening. How do they escape it?"
I do remember when I was first watching it, I was like, "What are they going to do?"
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, I think they did something that, like, made it pretty clear early on. I'm like, okay, it's not like a dream sequence or, like, you know.
Right.
I felt pretty early on that it wasn't, but I was like, well, it must be something, but how? And, you know, that was like, that was a really fun experience to have that. I mean, you know, that's what you get when you're a kid.
Yeah.
And they were able to pull it off.
Yep.
Had Gordon and Bullock, like, breaking into the Batcave and all that other stuff.
Yeah, lots of things that, like, you'll never see this. Oh, my God, we're seeing this.
Yep. You know, it's funny. Just earlier, before we did the podcast, I was griping how I didn't want heroes at odds with each other.
Yeah.
And this is one of my favorite stories.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a single story.
All right. This is Batman. There's another big anniversary.
Yeah.
And that, of course, is 6 years later, Terriers, 6 year Terriers anniversary, right?
Uh huh.
That's what we're talking about.
Yes. But who?
Oh, no. It's Star Trek.
Indeed.
Yeah.
50th anniversary? 50th
anniversary,
yeah. I think last Thursday, the first episode to air, The Man Trap, with the salt vampire creature, because I think they wanted to have a monstery one.
Yep.
Hit. And, you know, it's been going strong in some way, shape, or form ever since, except for, like, the last 10 years.
Right.
But then they came back with the new movies and all that stuff.
Yep.
And they're about to hit their new show. I think probably of us, I'm probably the most diehard Trekkie.
Which is funny, because you haven't seen all the episodes either.
Right. There's still some notable gaps in my knowledge, and, like, for instance, all of Deep Space Nine, which I know a lot of people love.
Where's our spectrum on this? We always have a spectrum. Am I in the middle? Because I watched a lot of Deep Space Nine, a few episodes of Voyager.
As far as, like, what, fondness for? Or fondness how many for, episodes
yeah.
you see?
Nick, where's your love for Star Trek?
I was a Next Gen guy. I watched a lot of Next Gen.
You probably watched more Next Gen than I did.
Probably so, but I've gone back and watched a lot of the original stuff, too.
So I may be at the far end. I may be the like Star Trek the least, and I like it quite a bit.
Yeah. Well, you know,
honestly, this might be our spectrum where we all like it.
Yeah, but Dave's definitely a bigger fan than you and I.
Randy's trying to find some way to hate it.
I am.
You know,
I did hate Voyager.
As big, you know what? I've been rewatching that on Netflix.
Is that the Scott Bakula one?
No, that's Enterprise. Enterprise. I didn't like that one either.
I've been rewatching. I've been watching episodes.
Anybody like that one?
Yes,
I like both of those.
Yeah,
actually, they're both ones where you have to get to Star Trek. Does have a weird thing that honestly is not. This is not to its credit, but that. On almost, except for the original series, almost all of them take about 2 to 3 seasons to get to their best stuff.
Yeah,
even
true.
Enterprise is acknowledged by people to have gotten decent and pretty good in its later seasons.
Yep.
And Voyager does too, kind of like circa the introduction of 7 of 9.
Some people hold up Voyager as their favorite Star Trek.
I haven't heard that often. I hear a lot more Deep Space Nine.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an original series guy who actually kind of didn't love Next Generation when it came around, but, like, watched it pretty devotedly just because the original series had made such an impact on me.
Right.
Next Gen is so much fun.
Well, the thing is, I would come around on it.
But Next Gen could be a little touchy-feely, and it also could be a little clumsy.
Right.
I mean, at times, yeah, but it had such great characters on it.
Well, you know, actually, in a way, the characters I didn't love nearly as much as the original because they didn't have that kind of that energy of conflict.
Yeah, they had Picard.
In fact, early on,
they had Data.
Well, they had Picard, Data, you know, Worf. Like, these characters actually had good moments, all of them. But it wasn't like, you know how Kirk, Spock, McCoy, you just put those guys in any scene and it's fun.
Yeah. It's a simple core dynamic.
Yep.
It's very archetypal.
And they didn't have that. They focused, they when Next Gen came out, they would kind of focus a little bit more on, like, exploring an idea. Sometimes they didn't have, like, a B-plot. Like, usually on on the original track, if there was like, oh, the Doomsday Machine is attacking, it'd be like, and our ship is losing power and plummeting down into a decaying orbit.
Right.
You know, they usually had two things to deal with. Or in the one Journey to Babel, that's where you meet Spock's parents.
Mm-hmm.
In it, they're actually having to, like, his dad has this rare condition and Spock's got to, like, do sort of a blood transfusion. And it's while, like, a saboteur is trying to destroy the delegation, you know, and disrupt things. So there's multiple events going on at once. Next Generation tended to drop that for a singular focused plot that they would kind of expand on more and grapple a little bit more with the morality of it. It was a drier approach, but, you know, a message board person kind of turned me around on it when he pointed out how very anti-80s macho culture it was.
That's true.
That, you know, in the midst of the Reagan macho 80s, here it was, this weekly show where a sort of intellectual Frenchman would come into the screen and solve problems with the power of, you know, compassion and, you know, intellect and
intellectual Frenchman, I think, is what he's called in the manga.
and it did give me, although I kind of like, I really love the boisterousness of the original series, and they got great sci-fi writers to work on that. Of course, that's always been a Star Trek tradition to kind of bring in sci-fi writers. I warmed up to Next Generation a lot for its kind of more thoughtful approach, even if it did veer a little touchy-feely at times.
Yeah.
It was kind of it's closer to what I believe. You know, it's the other one has a lot of vestiges of sort of 60s morality,
sure,
including, you know, casual sexism and stuff like that. That I don't really hold against it because it was so progressive in so many ways.
But it's not. It dates worse.
A little bit.
You know, it's interesting looking at this the Wikipedia. I was curious about when in the 80s it was. It was 87 to 94.
Yeah.
Because I always thought it was a 90s show, but I guess really it's 7 years. It spent half its time in the 80s. So.
Yeah. Technically less than half. It spent more time in the 90s.
A little less than half. It was 4 years in the, or 3 years in the 90s, or three years in the 80s and four in the 90s.
Yeah.
But it premiered to 27 million viewers, which there's no way the new one's getting anywhere near that.
Right.
And it was broadcast in first run syndication. That's so crazy. That is such a different time for TV. It didn't have a network.
Oh.
It was a syndicated show that people, like Xena and Babylon 5 and all those.
Yeah.
It was that era when cable networks were not developing their own programming, but they were just picking up syndicated shows.
Yeah.
It's an era that is bygone in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And those numbers, I mean, the new Star Trek show may be great, and it may be the first one that actually works right out the gate.
Right.
Because it's going to have to.
It has to.
At the same time, there's no matter how great it is, it's not going to get 27 million viewers.
Nah.
It may not get 27 million viewers across all 13 episodes.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's just the different TV world we're living in right now. It's just a more fractured sort of image. But, you know, Trek is, and it has been as influential as Star Wars. In fact, I think Star Wars probably wouldn't exist but for Trek, if I had to guess.
Yeah.
And I know that I've heard that Trek acknowledged that they wouldn't exist, have had the resurgence, if not for Star Wars.
Right.
So it kind of, one good turn to the other.
No, Dave, pick a side.
Star Wars came around in 77, did so well that they were able to greenlight the crappy Star Trek The Motion Picture.
Yep.
But it paved the way for Wrath of Khan and all the other good stuff.
Yeah, and those movies basically are what led to Next Generation existing.
Right. And if you're somebody who came in late and just now watched it through Abrams, you know, it's all part of that lineage.
And there's so much better things you can watch.
You'll watch the three seasons of Star Trek that are on Netflix.
Three series, right?
It's like 5 series and all seasons.
Yeah, all of it's on
Enterprise,
Netflix.
Deep Space Nine, Voyager, Next Generation original series.
When I clicked on just the original Star Trek, it was just 3 seasons long.
That's all it was.
It's only 3 seasons
that
long.
Was it?
Yep. Okay. And weirdly, opposite of all the others, its 3rd season was considered the one where it stumbled. I think they lost some of their funding there. The writing was a little bit weaker. Yeah.
And Star Trek, didn't it kind of struggle in its early days as far as ratings went?
Yeah, it was one of those that was, in constant danger of sort of cancellation. Yeah. They had to keep fighting it the whole time, there's all these great stories about how, Nichelle Nichols, who played Uhura, was not going to be on the show, but was Martin Luther King said, "This is important. You might want to consider it." And she did, and she became like an icon that has influenced women and especially actors of color ever since.
Yeah.
That also I've heard that Lucille Ball particularly, went to bat for the show.
Yeah, well, Desilu Productions, Lucille Ball is. I've been reading a book which I'll talk about later, but Desilu Productions was actually, as much as I Love Lucy was influential, they produced a lot of TV.
Right,
There was a lot of TV that was down to Lucy being sort of a media icon.
Right,
she was a producer as much as she was a star.
And yeah, I gather deserves a no small amount of credit for Star Trek happening, and therefore all of this phenomenon. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm a Trek fan.
So Dave, do you want to promote anything here?
Yeah. I wasn't sure if we were doing it here or near the end.
Well, it seems like a good time for it.
Yeah, it seems like a good time for it. So yes, I'm in fact working on a podcast. We've even recorded a few episodes with one of our customers, Stephen Fothery.
Yep.
He's just going to go by Fothery on the show.
Okay.
We're calling Tech Trek.
Yep.
It's going to be perspectives on Star Trek from here in the deep in the South. What we noticed, he noticed that there was just not a lot of Trek analysis, podcasts, and stuff going on anymore.
Yeah.
It hit a dry spell there in the 2000s where after Enterprise ended, and honestly, even before then, because that was considered kind of a lesser outing.
Yeah.
Where, Doctor Who became a much bigger thing. Star Trek faded away except for the movies, the Abrams movies, and even those were such popcorn-y kind of movies that they didn't inspire that same sort of level of kind of fandom that the original had.
Yeah.
And so he asked me if I had any interest in talking about such things, and I said, hell yeah, I'll talk about Star Trek.
So is it going to be weekly, bi-weekly, monthly? What's the deal?
I think we're going to be able to shoot for weekly.
Okay.
And we're actually doing it both as a a YouTube webcast and a podcast.
Oh, you guys are doing video?
Yes. So we've already recorded the first 2 episodes.
That is ambitious. We started TV Dudes with video. We quickly went away from it because it's a lot of work.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see if we maintain it. It is a lot of work, but he's doing that part, so what do I care?
You just got to show up and record?
I just got to show up and record, yeah.
Yeah, Dave, that's a trap because that's what I was doing on TV Dudes and it's not what it wound up being.
Anyway, we had a lot of fun with the first episode. As of the recording of this, I think I saw a message from Stephen earlier that he may be getting it put out. So
nice.
So it may be up and running.
Now, it's called Tech Trek. It is on iTunes and Google Play and all those kind of places.
Yeah, it should be on there. I don't know if it's up right now when you hear this, but it quite possibly is. We're going to have a website that's techstrek.com, so you can go there for all the basic stuff.
Is it techstrek.com or text-trek.com?
It's text-trek.com. Okay. And first episode is kind of our introduction and kind of batting around just what drew us to Trek, why we like it. We edited out some stuff that was kind of a quick lightning round of questions, but we're going to put together its own little separate episode out of that because it was just goofy questions like who's your Star Trek crush, and but it's fun though. I asked him who he thought the Jar Jar of Star Trek was, and
I want to know the answers to both those questions right now.
I can't tell you. You have to watch the
podcast. At least tell us who their Star Trek crush is. Who's your Star Trek crush?
My Star Trek crush is, and I was kind of going for characters that were not just one of the main characters. It's not just going to be Dr. Crusher or something.
Okay, Dr. Crusher's the obvious one.
Right. Dr. Crusher or Troy. You remember Tasha Yar's sister?
Yeah.
She showed up in one episode.
Okay.
She's played by this chick who looked kind of like Linda Hamilton.
Okay.
And I actually thought was her sister, but I've looked it up and she's not.
Okay.
Anyway, I have a long-standing crush on her as
Okay.
a trait.
I don't agree with someone doing more than one podcast in a week. I think that's probably I just think that's a danger.
Yeah,
I don't think anyone should do more than one podcast.
Sure. Maybe what about like three or four?
That's fine.
I think you do four or five.
I do three.
I will say, but our second episode, we specifically unpack everything that's known so far about the new series Star Trek Discovery.
Okay.
That we found a website that nicely has all the information on it. We kind of go through, chat up all, like, everybody who's participating in it, what they've been in before, kind of what we're expecting, what we're afraid of, you know, the weird format we talk about, the design of the ship, little snippets that we've heard about, like, diversity among the crew, what kind of aliens and threats they'll be facing, and so we're, if you're kind of wanting to get everything about the new show in one place, that second episode should cover it.
Nice. All right, well, that was a long intro, folks. In fact, it's almost as long as our usual podcasts. And in fact, as I look at my watch, we are done.
We're gonna
I thought we had like another hour, and I was not watching the clock carefully enough. So hopefully you guys really wanted to hear a lot about Batman and Star Trek this week.
It's hard to not get enthused about Batman.
So what we're gonna do is we're gonna real quick run through our picks, just gonna read them off, and then we will maybe talk about them next week when we talk about the rest of comics for next week. So my picks this week are Doom Patrol number 1 and The Fix number 5 and the Volume 1 trade paperback. Dave, your picks?
Yep. And I think Doom Patrol is one I think a lot of people are going to want to check out in particular. My number one pick this week is the second issue of Briggsland, the militia, realistic sort of militia comic, almost in the style of Sons of Anarchy. There's some really good stuff in this as the family goes out for payback after the bombing in the last issue. And my other pick is Detective Comics 940, the finale to the first arc. Big things happening here, including some big things that tie into kind of the larger DC Universe mysteries going on.
Nick?
Mine are the second issue of the All-Star Batman run, and the second issue of Red Hood and the Outlaws.
Okay. Batman week.
It is.
Also on my list, New Superman number 3, Faith number 3, Civil War Ulysses number 2, God of War 4, Civil War 2, Gods of War number 4, and Amazing Spider-Man Civil War number 4. As well as the new Black Mass book, The Forevers, the new sci-fi book from Image, Hadrian's Wall, which is by the creative team of Cowell, and the second volume of Charles Soule's Daredevil, which features a Spider-Man crossover and an Elektra appearance. Dave, what else is on your stack?
Randy, did you mention Faith?
Yes.
Faith number 3. There's fifth issue of Scooby Apocalypse. I was pretty happy with the first issue of the Gotham Academy for the rebirth. It's Gotham Academy second semester. There's a new issue of Suicide Squad, and the second issue of the Civil War Ulysses that I enjoyed quite a bit previously, but I haven't read this one yet, but it's probably good.
It's good. Nick?
All right, and I've got the 14th issue of Uncanny Avengers, the second issue of Jonathan Hickman's The Black Monday Murders, second issue of Deathstroke, second issue of Suicide Squad, the second issue of Batgirl and the Birds of Prey, and the 963rd issue of Action Comics, which...
Well, that seems like that must be, like, daily to get up to those numbers so quickly.
Starting the new arc.
It's basically starting the new story arc, focusing on the character of Clark Kent.
Are you going to reveal this truth about Clark Kent?
Seems like.
Seems that that is the case.
I'm going to guess he is secretly Mitzelplick.
That'll be interesting.
In a Clark Kent suit. All right, until next time...
Yo, Joe!
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating or review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.